Welcome back. Just want to set the stage for what we're doing today. You'll notice the title of this session is More Things to Know About Change. Last time we began to talk about that last element of the leadership process, the prayer and planning, making things real as far as getting the vision to become reality, that preferred future to become reality. And last time I introduced John Cotter's 8 steps to change, which have been tested over and over in organizations, that these are things that are necessary, steps that are necessary in order for change to work. Oftentimes change happens and things go right back to what they were. In fact, in the first church I served, you know, we went through a period of change, and after I left, things went right back. It was like, you know, we talked about that rubber band of going back. That church had a history of growth and then decline, growth and decline, growth and decline, and it's because they never really changed. They would change on the surface, but it didn't get to that last one of anchoring the new approach in the culture. So today we're going to look at generating short-term wins and then consolidating gains and producing more change and then anchoring the new approach in the culture so that it becomes the culture. Generating short-term wins. Change happens when you can demonstrate that the changes that are happening with the goal out there and moving us toward the goal are good. This is working. Now, what is a short-term win? You can look at it in a variety of ways. Dave Ramsey is a Christian kind of financial consultant guru. He has written books. He's got a radio program. He appears on television. He does specials all over. And he's got a system that he works. The system begins with baby steps, like establishing an emergency fund. You set aside money for emergencies that can come up. And then step two is, you know, getting out of debt. And it's interesting how he describes how you get out of debt. And his suggestion is you end up with no debt except maybe the long-term debt on a house or something like that. So how do you do that? Well, surprisingly, he didn't say, okay, look at your biggest debt, you know? Look at your student loan debt or something like that. He didn't say that. What he says is you get the easiest ones first. You pick the easiest debt to pay off. It might be this particular credit card. You're going to work over this next month to pay that off. He said, people find they can do it. Sometimes they have to take a second part-time job to do it, but they pay that off. And he said, then they look at the next easiest one. What's the next easiest debt to pay off? And it may be a debt to a friend who lent them money at some point. You pay it off. You work at it. You pay it off. You describe, get to work on maybe a second job, maybe something else. You sell something, but you pay off that second debt. But you start with the easiest ones first. And the reason for that is that that creates momentum. It creates momentum toward more change. Put down there the old church, Old First Church. I have a friend in town who is a pastor of another denomination than my own, but we came the same week. And so we got to know each other. We ran into each other and began to explore things. And so we've had connection for the past 11 and a half years. He's doing a new program now, which I'm jumping on board a bit, that's called Pastor Partners. Where the idea is to take a retired pastor with some skills and experience and partner them with, over a short period of time, partner them with a pastor in a solo church. Now, he did this. This was the brainchild of a businessman in his church because Old First Church was stuck. They had made a lot of change in 11 years, and the church had a history of destroying its pastors, some of them even becoming mentally ill and in institutions. And so there was a lot of work that was needed to set the basis for change, but my friend hung in there and did it. But now they kind of reached a plateau, and a more change was just not happening. People had gotten complacent again. And so what's going to break that? What's going to make that unstuck? And so the idea of bringing somebody in who's got experience and just being an impetus for more change was the brainchild. And so a retired pastor who was known by this businessman came in. They made a 6-month contract of this is what you're going to do. Part of it was starting a new program that the pastor had wanted to see implemented for a long time. A part of it was training and retraining and redeploying and getting the evangelism committee. That's what they had. Going again because it kind of sunk into nothingness. Part of it was preaching once in a while, etc., etc. So that first 6 months, there were some changes that happened. There was a new program that was started. My pastor friend had a dream always of kind of being the marriage center. And so they devised this program where they would invite couples in the community who weren't part of the church to be married in Old First Church. And the idea was they would offer them premarital counseling for free by a qualified counselor. They would offer them the church facility at no cost if they would be married there. They could use the gym for the gym / social hall for a reception afterwards, and that would be at a very reduced rate. And so, lo and behold, you know, the retired pastor coming in, the pastor partner comes in, and he's got the energy and the time that the pastor doesn't. And so he begins working on this, and they got four couples enrolled in a very short time. All who are going to get married in the next year. And surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, three out of the four are attending First Church. And none of them had attended church before. But they came in contact with Christians through this process. They had Jesus Christ presented to them, and they began attending. And so, that's a short-term win, right? You say, wow, this is fantastic. Things went so well the first 6 months, they signed up for another 6 months of this pastor-partner process. And again, there were short-term wins. Old First Church has been dying for decades. And all of a sudden, they have this uptick, 10 people in new members class. And so they talk about that, and they say, wow, you know, look at it, they're friends of people here. And there's been this invitation process, and so let's celebrate that. They celebrated short-term wins. And now they're looking at more change. Instead of the pastor partner model, they're looking at hiring somebody full time to be that kind of assistance, to be that impetus for change. So short-term wins are very important to moving toward the vision, to getting permission for change and more change. So what is a short-term win? Well, there are three characteristics. First of all, a short-term win is visible. People can see it for themselves. In Old First Church, they say, wow, look at all the visitors here. I don't know so-and-so. People have been around and knew everybody. All of a sudden, don't know everybody. And it's that sense of, wow, you know, some of this stuff is working. It's visible. People can see it for themselves. If it's a money issue that's been the crisis and there's been change toward that, to say, oh, look at the offerings are up. Or, wow, look at what we've been able to do. If it's a facility issue, which are easy to do because they're very visible, you can say, look at that. That improvement to the facility is happening. Those rooms are being reconstructed. The painting is doing well. It's a visible short-term win that can be celebrated. And it's unambiguous. It's obviously a win. It's not something you can create or manufacture or try to pretend. And thirdly, it's got to be clearly related to the change effort. In other words, it's got to be something clearly related to the vision and the goals that you have set. You find those things, and you're going to find that there becomes a momentum toward more change, which indeed is what happens. It puts pressure on to fulfill the vision. Because now as a leader and your guiding coalition can say, wow, yeah, we're moving toward it. We find out we can do it. Let's go. Now, one word of warning. This needs a good combination of management and leadership. Now, many of us who are spiritually gifted in leadership do not have the gift of administration or management. That's true for me. And so I think that, you know, once the idea has been bought, that we're on the road. But to manage short-term wins, to identify them, to celebrate them, take somebody who's aware of details and is planning those details and watching those details. And in Cotter's book, you can read about the balance that there's got to be between leadership and management. But let me just say to you now that if you're going to have short-term wins and you're going to have them celebrated appropriately and you're going to have attention drawn to them appropriately and the people who are doing those short-term wins are resourced appropriately, you're going to need managers around you if you are somebody who's gifted in leadership. So, a word to the wise. So, we've looked at establishing a sense of urgency, creating a guiding coalition, developing a vision and strategy, communicating the change vision, empowering for broad-based action, and generating short-term wins. Step number 7 is consolidating gains and producing more change. Now, a word here, this is a quote from Cotter, resistance is always waiting to reassert itself. You know, I've used that example of a rubber band. If you keep pushing it apart, eventually one or two things are going to happen. One, if the pressure pushing it out begins to relieve, it's going to snap back into its old position. That's what will happen with resistance. Now, what you hope will happen is the other thing that can happen is if you do this, is that you keep it there long enough and with enough pressure that the rubber band begins to change and it loses some of its elasticity and so it stays there. That's the idea here, is you consolidate gains so that things have changed. Things have changed. And people now begin to realize that, oh, hey, the world is not falling down. Hey, how about that? We can change and it's not so incredibly terrible. So you begin to consolidate the change. Now, a few words that you need to know here, and that is about systems theory. It's a complex theory, very simple in one sense, but complex in another, in that the idea is that everything's a system. So your church or your organization is a system, and a closed system. And within that system, there are all these relationships between people, and there's communication issues that if you get a group of 40 people together, the issues between them, everybody communicating with everybody else, the lines cross like crazy. In fact, I put in my search engine, show me an image or a diagram of systems theory, and here's one of them I came up with. You look at it and you say, what in the world is going on in there? You've got all these subsystems relating to each other, unit, department, functions. You've got a subsystem running this way. You've got the subsystem running that way, and they're relating to each other. Information has to be passed from one organization, part of the organization, to another, to another, to another, in order to have output toward the goal of the organization. Now, that's complex, but it's very simple in some respects. Marriage counselors will talk about the fact that marriage, a family, is a system. It begins when people get married. So you've got a husband and you've got a wife. And it's a pretty simple system then because the communication patterns are easy. They go from husband to wife, from wife to husband. And sometimes, in times of conflict, which we'll talk about, they go around from wife back to wife. But now you add a child to it, and you've got a whole other set of communications that are needed around that. And then you add two children, three. And the system just begins to become incredibly complex, even within a family. Now, when I was studying this, I was in a class last year in which they were teaching about systems theory. And the leader had us get into a large group. There were about 40 of us. So it's a wide open room. And she just gave us an instruction. She said, you know what? You've got to identify two other people. You don't need to tell them who they are. You don't need to know, have anybody else know who they are. But we're going to start moving around in a moment. And I want you to remain equidistant from those two people. So I'm moving here. And, I'm looking at these two people. And I'm trying to stay equidistant from them. And there are other people who are trying to remain equidistant from that one or that one. And there are some that are, I'm in their group. And they're trying to remain equidistant from me. And then she says, all right, just start moving around. So you start taking some random steps, and the whole system begins to adjust because there are these random steps that are taking. And she says, okay, now stop. And now, she said, I want to make it a little more complex to make it like a system of a church. She says, I'm going to enter in as the leader, as the transitional pastor, let's say that I am. So she enters the system, and the direction is maintain equidistance from me and the two others now. And so once again, we began moving, and there's this complex set of movements that go on. That's a system. If you've got a church or organization of over 10 people, it's a complex system, can be, because you've got all these interrelations that are going on, and some aren't aware of the others, and some aren't aware of those, and there's communication that's given to some that's not given to others. It's a complex system. But the good news is the system can be changed. Years ago, I thought I was going to go into marriage counseling, one of those times early in ministry where I thought I was going to leave because I was burned out. And I went and explored counseling. So I took some classes, read a lot of books in counseling, and I was doing more of that in my church than probably I should have, and that's a philosophical decision on my part. But one of the things I learned is that one person can change the system because if a wife comes in, which is the normal thing, complaining about her husband, complaining about the marriage and the quality of marriage and the impact on the family, a counselor can say to her, if you change the way you relate to him, and you change the way you relate to your children, it's going to change the system. Sometimes very positively, very quickly. And so the wife comes in and identifies ways that she usually responds to her husband's egging on or nagging or whatever. And now we're going to find a new way of responding to that. And what happens to the system then? What happens to what the children see? How they, you can change the system. It starts with, you've got some changes happening and people say, this is working. So you consolidate your gains. You spend a time celebrating the fact that you've reached a new plateau or a new moment where you're going to launch toward further change. We had one of these just last year before I retired. And we had finally paid off all the debt on the building. We had a debt from a three-year debt from an expansion project that we did. And we'd managed to pay it off in 3 years. And so we had time in the worship services where we celebrated that. You know, we didn't have a mortgage to burn. We never had a mortgage, but we had loans from a local bank. And so we took their letter in which they identified the fact that we were now debt-free, and we burned it in the worship service. And we said, look, you know what? The changes we projected as far as children's ministry are working. Look at all that's been happening because we revamped the youth ministry area and we built this children's ministry area. Look at what's happening in the adult ministry now that we have these rooms where we didn't have adult ministry before. We were simply consolidating our gains and looking toward the future. So, what do you do when you're doing that? Well, you introduce more change. That's how you consolidate gains and produce more. You then say, you know what, here's the next ones. You hire or engage new people. Now what's going to happen is, in your organization, as you've gone through some change, is that new people will have joined. And they don't know all of the history. And interestingly, they tend to be the people who volunteer more quickly than the longer-term members. So you hire them, you recruit them as volunteers, you get them engaged. It was kind of a shocking thing when we were moving. You know, we were going through a relocation when I was in California, and the youth pastor said, just think, you know, we move into this big, beautiful new building. Says the people that are coming from now on aren't even going to know the history. They aren't going to know what it's like to be in that temporary facility. They aren't going to know what it's like to be in the old building. They're only going to know the new. And that reality, they don't even know the changes that have happened to get where we are. But they're more ready to go for more change. So hire and engage new people. And, oops, sorry, I did a spell check there. People. And then marginalize the critics. Stop giving them a voice. Don't let them, you know, monopolize situations. Have, if you do congregational meetings or group meetings and you know some of them are going to speak up, make sure that you've got some of your guiding coalition ready to respond. You know, don't let them control the narrative. So, consolidating gains. Step 8 is anchoring the new approach in the culture. Now, to do that requires time. But people began to talk about the way we do things here differently as you've anchored something in the culture. And it requires a lot of talk time, a lot of repeating the message, and it's going to involve turnover. You know, I said that in our worship history that one of the things we did in our church every week was read the Ten Commandments. Well, when we stopped doing that, you would think that for some people it was such a radical change. You know, that we were throwing not just the baby out with the bathwater, but we were stomping on the baby once he got out. It was that kind of powerful change for people, and so we had some people leave. Interestingly, not one of them went to a church where they read the Ten Commandments every week, but they were so incensed that we were doing that in our change that they felt they had to leave. There's going to involve turnover. Some people will not buy into the new change, and they will they'll leave. They'll leave. Which may be preferable for them to becoming entrenched critics, but you've just got to be aware of that. You can't take everybody along. And then you've got to start making decisions about succession. When I came to California, I partnered with a guy. When I came there, I was surprised that he was really on his way out. I had looked at this partnership. I was going to be the partner who's old enough to be my father, but somebody was skilled in evangelism, and I thought, I'm going to work with this guy, and together we're going to build this church. And then I found that he's entertaining calls to other churches. And I was astounded at that. And so one time I confronted him with that and said, wait, what? I hear you're talking with such and such a church about becoming their pastor. What's this about? And what he shared was, he said, you know, we searched for you. He says, because we've undergone a lot of change. And the concern was that my successor here would be somebody who would be from the old guard or guided, chosen by people from the old guard, and those changes would be abandoned. So we looked for somebody who was, as he put it, further out in left field than I am, so that we could encourage the ongoing changes necessary to reach our vision. That's how I got to California. And so when you're anchoring the new approach in the culture, it means you're looking long term. How do we keep this going for a long time? So that's Cotter's 8 steps, and I just want to encourage you in them. And then there's one more final word about change. Now, there's another book that I could tell you to read. It's an excellent book. It's called Switch. It's written by two business consultants again, Dan and Chip Heath. But they gave a picture as I read that book that has stuck with me about change. And that is, they pictured life as, or an organization as, a man riding an elephant. And they said, now that's an elephant's a powerful creature, but the man can make that elephant go certain directions for a period of time. And they said, now let the man represent the logical or rational approaches toward life. And let the elephant represent the feelings. He said, the rational part of the people you deal with in your organization can force the elephant to go certain directions for a period of time. You can make a rational argument why you should do some things. You know, why you should change. The church is dying. We've got statistics that prove it. We've got this ministry that we see can make a difference, and we want to adopt it and make it part of our own church. They'll rationally agree with you, but eventually their feelings will win out. And so as you start thinking about changes in your organization, you've got to, as I put down at the bottom there, aim for people's feelings. You talk about what this means for the kids. You tell stories of people who are impacted because there has been change. You talk about the people who have come to faith. You know, we regularly had testimony time in my previous church, just because we wanted people to say, you know what, our changes in worship, that was hard, it was painful. But look, we've got this influx of new people who find us relevant, and not only find us relevant, they're meeting Jesus Christ as a result. We've got people who are out there serving because they've been challenged to serve as a fulfillment of our vision to become a church for the community. And they're doing it. Let's tell you the story about that. Because stories hit emotions, and you're aiming for people's emotions. You want people to buy in because they see it's making a difference in people's lives. It's not just a rational explanation of why something has to be changed. So next time, we're going to continue to talk about Cotter's thing, only in the sense of a book that he wrote later that gave an allegory of all this and how it works within an organization and how it likely can work in your organization. So we'll see you next time.